Someone said to me recently that they very much enjoy office Christmas parties, but they told me that what they don't like is always having to look for a new job the next day. Well, I hope your countdown to Christmas has been going slightly better than that. One of the essentials of my countdown to Christmas over the last few years at least has been going to see school nativity plays. And I've got the hang of them now. They always end with this beautiful tableau. You've got Mary, Joseph, the baby in the manger. And I guess we all find it charming. But for many of us, I think we're left asking the question, well, so what? And actually, that may be the last we think about Jesus for another year. Mentally, he's left there in the manger. Cute, but perhaps irrelevant. Or for others of us, it's not that we forget about Jesus exactly. But one of the challenges, and I think this is true for me, is that the message of Christmas becomes a bit over familiar. We just can't seem to get as excited about it anymore. And that's why I'm really grateful for this chance now to reflect on why Christmas is a complete game changer for our world. If you've passed Southwark Station over the past few weeks, you'll have seen this giant 50-foot poster with this thought-provoking question. If history could be folded, where would you put the crease? And it's a great question, and I'm sure there'll be all kinds of ingenious answers to it that people will give. But it's striking, isn't it, that our very dating system, BC and AD, puts the crease of history at the birth of Jesus Christ. In fact, whatever we happen to think about Jesus, it's difficult to deny his unique significance. H.G. Wells of War of the Worlds fame, he once wrote this: "I'm a historian, I'm not a believer. But I must confess as a historian that this penniless preacher from Nazareth is irrevocably the very centre of history. Jesus Christ is easily the most dominant figure in all history. He is unique." And at one level, the impact of Jesus Christ on our world is a very strange and a very surprising phenomenon given his ordinariness. Dr. James Francis, writing at the beginning beginning of the 20th century, described the oddity of Jesus like this: "Here is a man who was born in an obscure village, the child of a peasant woman. He never wrote a book, he never held an office, he never had a family or owned a home. He never set foot inside a large city. He never travelled 200 miles from the place he was born. He did none of the things that usually accompany greatness. 19 centuries have come and gone, and today he is the central figure for much of the human race. When we try to sum up his influence, all the armies that ever marched, all the navies that ever sailed, all the parliaments that ever sat, and all the kings that ever reigned, put together, have not affected the life of people on this earth as powerfully as this one solitary life." Now that is quite a claim, but it's hard to dispute Jesus' unique significance. And the Apostle John, who's writing this account we've just had read, he was one of Jesus' closest friends. He saw Jesus' life close up. And he tells us in this passage we just looked at what it is about Jesus that accounts for his uniqueness. He begins his gospel like this. Have a look again if you've got them in front of you, the first page. "In the beginning was the Word." He's talking there about Jesus, God's self-revelation, the Word. And he continues, "And the Word, Jesus, was with God." That is Father and Son together. "And the Word, Jesus, was God." There it is, this extraordinary claim that in Jesus, God himself has come. And John, who's writing this, he's a first century Jew. He's steeped in a monotheistic tradition. He knows there is only one God. And he knows that we must not therefore use God language carelessly about creatures. And yet over his 3 years with Jesus of Nazareth, he's come to see that for Jesus, no other language will fit. And actually, that's one of the reasons we've put these John's Gospels on the seats, because it gives us all a chance to take away the eyewitness accounts and to have a look at some of the evidence which John collects for us. Because Jesus not only claimed to be God, he consistently backed it up with stuff that only God can do. He fulfilled countless prophecies from the Old Testament. He lived a perfect life, which no one could fault. He fed 5,000 people with just a few tuna rolls. He healed a man born blind. He created new faculties out of nothing. He called a rotting corpse out of the tomb. It's interesting, plenty of people chose not to believe Jesus and follow him at the time, but not even his enemies could deny the reality of his miracles. And perhaps most strikingly, he returned from the grave himself, just like he said he would, convincing ardent skeptics that he really had been raised. So if you are a sincere seeker, can I encourage you to check it out yourself and have a read? As the news about Ebola broke earlier this year, there were all kinds of responses to that suffering. But Nancy Ritterbull, a 59-year-old nurse, she wanted to do more. And she decided to go in person to help the Ebola sufferers in Liberia. For Nancy, caring for the Ebola sufferers was very costly. And in August, as she devoted herself to caring for those patients, she herself caught the disease. For Nancy, her love of these Ebola sufferers meant not just going in person to help them, but ultimately becoming one of them. She herself became an Ebola sufferer. And in a similar way, the God who knows and sees the suffering in this world, who cares deeply about each of the people he's made, he came in person to this world. And that's not all. He was so devoted to helping us that, like Nancy, he became one of us. In Jesus, God himself became a human being. Now, thankfully, Nancy is now recovered. But for Jesus, becoming one of us ultimately entailed giving his own life for us. And actually, it's the enormity of this claim that can shake us out of our over-familiarity with Christmas. One writer describes the scandal of Christmas like this. How can you put the earthquake into a test tube or the sea into a bottle? How can you live with the terrifying thought that the hurricane has become human, that the fire has become flesh, that life itself came to life and walked in our midst? Christianity either means that or it means nothing. It is either the most devastating disclosure of the deepest reality in the world, or it's a sham and it's a nonsense. So do you see, this claim is so huge, it must be all or nothing. Jesus cannot fit neatly onto the shelf next to all of the other truth claims. Jesus demands either to be thrown off the shelf altogether and ignored, or to be worshipped and adored. Now this writer John, he's only just begun his account, and next he gives us another big shock, and that is that when our Creator came amongst us, we, human beings, did not welcome him. So God's intention was that everyone in the world would recognize and respond rightly to Jesus. And of course, how could we miss him? We were wired to recognize him. Verse 9 says this, "The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world." It's saying that the reason, the logic behind the universe, the one we were created to immediately resonate with and receive as our Lord and God, had arrived. And yet, verse 10, he was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. I don't know whether you're optimistic or pessimistic about human nature. We seem to be this crazy mix, don't we, of divine spark and yet hellish inhumanity so often. But John wants us to see that given who Jesus is, the most important thing about us as a human race and as individuals must be our response to Jesus. And according to John, the defining, exposing moment is that when it came down to it, we crucified our Creator. Not just homicide, but deicide. Now, instinctively, when we hear that, we want, don't we, to point the finger and we say, well, that was them, not us. You know, we would never do something like that. But the point is that Jesus went to the best of humanity. He went to his own people. But verse 11, even his own did not receive him. And actually, for all our sophistication, our hearts are no different from theirs. When we see the light, We turn from it rather than running to it. There was an American preacher at the turn of the 20th century who described the scandal of rejecting our Creator like this. He said, suppose you had a mother who was one of the noblest women who ever lived. And suppose that mother loved you with even greater love than a mother ordinarily loves her child. And suppose that mother would be willing to lay down her life and to die for you. And now suppose that you were to do your duty by everyone else. But that old mother that loves you, that has suffered for you, that would be willing to die for you, now suppose you turned her out on the streets to starve and to perish. What would you say about yourself? And he continues, Jesus Christ is holier, better, nobler than any mother that ever lived. Jesus Christ not only loved you enough to die for you, he actually did die for you. Now suppose you do your duty by everyone else, but utterly fail in your duty to Jesus Christ. What would you say of yourself? And the point of his question is that no relationship that we have is as significant or as important as the relationship with the one who made us and who gives us everything we have, the one who loves us more than any other. And therefore, whatever achievements we may have in life, and in this room there'll be some amazing achievements, but actually all of that is secondary if we've neglected and ignored the one who should mean more to us than any other, our loving Creator. And yet the wonderful news of the gospel is, despite the way that we have treated him, wonderfully Jesus still offers to welcome us into God's family. Let's look at verse 12 together. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he, Jesus, gave the right to become children of God. As we read through this gospel, and I'm encouraging you to do so, we discover that at the heart of all reality is a love relationship. When Jesus calls God Father, which he does dozens of times in this gospel, he's actually pulling back the veil on a love relationship which has always existed between God the Father and God the Son, a relationship of perfect love and delight and intimacy. And for those who will welcome Jesus, God draws us in to this relationship, the relationship for which we were made. And actually discovering this has changed everything in my own life. So many of the things that I did once live for, like doing well and being liked, I discovered that all these things are actually pretty flimsy. Not only are they never quite enough, they can actually all be taken away like that. But this relationship with God, being God's child, is something that truly satisfies. And what's more, it can never be taken away from us. It will last even through death. This is the most precious thing imaginable. At Christmas, we celebrate that God was born into our human family so that we can be born into his divine family forever. I heard a story recently about a woman, an elderly lady, struggling to pay her rent. And so her church got together some funds, and that someone was nominated to go round to her door and to drop it round to her. And they knocked and they knocked, but she didn't open the door. And the reason was, she thought it was the bailiff. She thought it was people come to take her possessions away. And I think lots of us do the same with God. We don't answer the door to him because we're convinced he wants to take things away from us, our life, our dreams, our freedom. But the reality is exactly the opposite. God is knocking at the door, longing to give us what we most need, if only we will let him. And so whether for us it's for the first time, or perhaps for some of us for the umpteenth time, Christmas is a great time for each one of us to open that door, to thank God for this incredible gift, and to receive this relationship which he offers us. Thank you.